Lobruto introduces the chapter on fear and desire as follows. More than 3 years before the ultimate March 31st, 1953 release of Fear and Desire, Stanley Kubrick walked into 369 Lexington Avenue, the New York offices of Richard the Rochemont. Now you might say, how can he possibly know this? However, interestingly, if you check the footnotes of the book or the references at the back, there actually is apparently a huge de Rochemont collection, and a lot of the information that Lobruto uses is either based on those papers in that collection or on interviews, which of course then it's tricky whether the memory is correct or not, with de Rochemont. Now, de Rochemont is an important figure here because he had been the producer of The March of Time. Don't forget, Singer works for The March of Time. They originally wanted to sell Day of the Pike, The March of the Time, but Kubrick actually marches into the Rochemont's office, apparently at the beginning of 1953, with a script he had co-written with a high school friend called Howard Sackler. Yet again, a writer who was then an amateur, but later actually won the Pulitzer Prize for a boxing movie called The Great White Hope, I think. First a play, and then a movie. And I think he won the Pulitzer Prize for the play much later. And he also wrote one of the drafts of Jaws, Howard Sackler. So Kubrick walks into this office with this script. Now, we don't know why. What does he expect? Because after all, de Rochemont produces The March of Time, not feature films. However, it was already at that time that de Rochemont was thinking about moving into feature films, following his brother, Louis de Rochemont, who had been the producer of March of Time and then launched a major career as an independent producer afterwards. So there's a sense that perhaps Kubrick thought that either Richard de Rochemont or his brother Louis would help him to finance this film. Now, this did not happen. The script that he submitted was not in any way taken up by those two. However, Richard Rochemont became a mentor for Kubrick, and he, amongst other things, for example, he invested $500 in the post-production of Fear and Desire in autumn 1951, and also in 1952, and we're going to come back to the crisis that Kubrick was in at that moment in 1952, de Rochemont helped Kubrick to get a job as a second unit director on a television program that de Rochemont was producing for television. So this connection is actually quite important because it gives Kubrick some backup, financial but also moral support, as it were, and future employment possibilities in case this whole feature film career goes down the drain, which it was likely to do and looked like doing for a long time. And I think the contact with de Rochemont, March of Time being distributed through Fox, indicates that right from the start, Kubrick wanted to work for the mainstream. Yeah, he didn't go to some arty-farty person. He went to someone who represented, together with his brother, medium-budget, high-profile, quality production for the major studios, whether it's short films or features. This intention to enter the mainstream is actually confirmed by the publicity that Kubrick managed to generate. He was nothing if not wise to the power of publicity. The Stanley Kubrick archive contains an astonishing number of press clippings from December 1950 onwards. Remember, none of Kubrick's films has been released yet. Day of the Fight is released in spring 51, as is Flying Padre. He's just this guy who's a star photographer at Look magazine, but he manages to generate this publicity. And the early articles that appear in the press focus on Kubrick's young age, his precocious achievements as a former Look photographer, because by that time he had stopped, by December 1950, he had stopped his staff position at Look. He was just a freelance filmmaker now. His also precocious achievement as a documentary filmmaker, although none of them had been released by December 1950, there was already knowledge that they were coming out. And the sheer audacity that this young man had, with no experience whatsoever, to make a feature film. Yeah. So that was the initial publicity that he generated. The early publicity also suggested something that we already encountered in Alexander Singer's memories, which may or may not be reliable. But there are interview statements from Kubrick from 1950, 51, 52, where he says that he wants to be in control of his films, but also wants to make it in Hollywood. So this idea that you can be in control of your film, but draw on all the resources of a major studio, seems to have been widely spread for naive young men to just waltz into someone's office and say, hey, give me money. I'll give you an example. In December 1950, there's an article called "A 20-year-old producer makes real films for fun and profit." And it quotes Kubrick saying, and that's interestingly, partly to keep the cost of film production down, he says, "There won't be any time lost in argument or discussion. There'll be only one boss, me." Yeah, but the interesting thing is he says this because he says, if we have discussion, we lose money. We don't have any money. Yeah, so it's not like I'm the artist, I'm the genius, you have to listen to what I say. It's more like, God, we got to do this fast, and we have to agree on some basic rules here. And interestingly, the article from December 1950, this is amazing, ends with a reference to a legendary independent producer of big-budget movies, next to David Selznick and Walt Disney, the legendary independent producer in Hollywood, of big-budget movies, Sam Goldwyn. Because the article ends, after portraying Kubrick, it says, "Are you listening, Sam Goldwyn?" It's almost like there's a competition now for Sam Goldwyn for the top spot as someone who both makes films under his own control, but uses all the resources of the major studios to make them. That's extraordinary, that a young filmmaker who has no film out whatsoever is written up as the next Sam Goldwyn, one of the most powerful people and most influential people in the film industry. Quite extraordinary. So what I'm saying is Kubrick was really good at publicity. There's also this sense that Kubrick, one quote, you know, when he actually shoots Fear and Desire in spring 1951, one article says he's knocking on the doors of Hollywood. So he moves from New York to California to shoot the film, but the idea is that he's knocking on the doors of Hollywood. This idea that, independent or not, he wants to become a Hollywood player. Kubrick is never quoted in any of these articles as saying that he actually wanted to make films in Hollywood, but there's no alternative. No one can imagine what else would he want to do. And Kubrick doesn't say so either. And I think the implication is, as I suggested through the connection with De Rochemont, that he was actually heading to the heart of the film industry. He never saw himself as someone who works in the art film sector or the experimental sector. Now, when it comes to actually making Fear and Desire, he actually takes a very similar approach to the approach he had taken to Day of the Fight. He raised the funding privately. It doesn't go to an established production company, major or minor. He actually raises the funding privately, mainly from an uncle, who is a wealthy drugstore. You see a pattern here? Reasonably wealthy father, wealthy uncle, you know? If you want to become a filmmaker, make sure you get a wealthy family. He puts together his own crew, mostly friends, because they're willing and cheap. He hires a cast, mostly of complete unknowns, because he couldn't pay anyone who wasn't completely unknown. He directed, photographed, edited, and produced the film himself. Once again, we have to think about, this sounds like, oh, Kubrick is totally independent. Well, yes, but he's forced again to take on multiple roles. He doesn't choose to do all these things himself. He can't afford to pay anyone for it. He collaborates with someone else on the script. Very important, it's not his own script, he works with someone else. Sackler gets the only credit, but it's actually a joint effort. He depends on the goodwill of his probably very badly paid collaborators. It's not like he says, I pay you your salary, you do what I say. No, he doesn't pay them, or he pays them a pitiful amount. So if they say, Stanley, that's it, I'm out of here, you know, because they have no reason to stay unless he treats them well, which presumably means he has to negotiate with them, which is, I think, how we should see the filmmaking process anyway. It's not one person imposing themselves on the others. And he has obligations towards his financier, his uncle. The original budget that they thought they could work with was $10,000. Once again, they failed to take into account post-production. You can shoot a film cheaply, but you cannot edit and score it cheaply. So the budget ends up $53,500. That's 15 times the average salary of a person at that time. And of course, in order to fulfill his obligations towards its uncle, namely to get the money back, he needs to find a buyer for the finished film. Now, here's the puzzle in all of this. With Day of the Fight, he makes the film, he knows March of Time, and failing March of Time, another Screen magazine will buy. Who he thought would buy Fear and Desire is a complete utter mystery. It's difficult to see what established film format or what kind of buyer Kubrick had in mind. We're talking about 15 times a person's salary that he now owns, annual salary that he now owes his uncle. He needs to get the money back. What was he thinking? And I'm going to ask you that question. You will appreciate the question when you actually watch the film. It's a very curious film indeed. The project was initially entitled The Trap. It did contain elements familiar from war movies. A New York Times article from January 1951 described the film as follows. A story about four soldiers in a battle who are trapped behind enemy lines. Okay, that sounds conventional enough. And then Kubrick is quoted. It is a study of four men and their search for the meaning of life and the individual's responsibility to the group. You might say, okay, it's a bit heavy-handed, but we can sort of say, yeah, war movies do that kind of thing. Man, meaning of life, responsibility, yeah. Except for the reference to the meaning of life, perhaps, and the fact that the war that is actually being fought in the film is never mentioned. It's never identified what war it is. Apart from that, we could conceivably say that this is a World War II combat movie. Yeah, it fits a kind of pattern. However, that's at the stage when the film was still, being made. However, by the time that the film, now entitled Shape of Fear, was completed, sometime late in 1951 or early 1952, it did not look or sound like a conventional movie. Now, I could tell you why, but that's one of the questions on the handout, because you're going to watch the movie and you're going to tell me why I can possibly think that it doesn't look like a conventional movie. Now, why? What do we make of this? We could, of course, say, oh, Kubrick is an independent artist. He doesn't play by the rules. He just makes it. Yeah, we could say that. But frankly, the guy owns 15 annual salaries to his uncle. Yeah? He really owes this guy. Plus, of course, his career depends on this film finding a buyer and getting into cinemas. What was he thinking? I actually think he simply miscalculated. I think he thought Fear and Desire, it's going to pull in the punters, they're going to pay big bucks, and we're all going to get rich on it, and I'm going to get a great Hollywood career. I think it's a question of a utterly disastrous, but I think understandable miscalculation. In any case, miscalculation or not, Kubrick works extremely hard to sell the film. Already in June 1952, a few months after he had completed the film, he gets a well-known literature professor. And you think, oh, well-known literature professor, who cares? No, this was a guy who gave talks in New York, advertised in the New York Times. Hundreds of people showed up. It's a guy called Mark Van Doren. And he gets this guy, he shows him the film, and the guy writes him a blurb. The film is brilliant and unforgettable. And it goes on actually quite a bit. It's a brilliant blurb. And that blurb he can then use to approach distributors and says, look, Mark Van Doren says, it's brilliant. You better buy it. However, the major studios all turn him down, at which point he turns to an art house distributor, someone who distributes into films which basically show imports from Europe which are sort of arty. Mostly French neorealism and Italian neorealism and what one might call a kind of post-war French, noir impressionism or whatever. I don't know. I just made that up. Don't quote me on that. Erase that. But how does he introduce his film to this guy? Yeah, this is Kubrick selling his film. The whole thing with it being a World War II combat movie for the major studios, that has failed. Now, he writes to Burstyn, Joseph Burstyn, in November 52 about the film. Its structure, allegorical. Its conception, poetic. A drama of man, in inverted commas, lost in a hostile world, deprived of material and spiritual foundation, seeking his way to an understanding of himself and of life around him. He is further imperiled on his odyssey by an unseen but deadly enemy that surrounds him, but an enemy who, upon scrutiny, seems to be almost shaped from the same mold. Now, you might say, okay, we can see that he's now not addressing the major studios anymore. This is not your pitch for a World War II combat movie. One might, however, say that this kind of tone, this kind of quality that he seems to evoke is typical for what American critics thought about European art house imports at the time. And that, of course, makes a lot of sense for him to do that because he wants to sell it to an art house distributor. And indeed, Burstyn wants to buy the film. And some of the reviews actually then say, there's one review which says that Kubrick's film is very arty and it tries to capture the photographic qualities and flavor of a European product. So that actually is how the film was received once it was released. So the whole sense of what Kubrick tried to do worked, and Burstyn buys the film. Now, an added incentive, and that's where it gets interesting, is that the film has a sexual dimension. Yeah. Now, you may not know this, but art house distributors in the late 40s and early 50s, and frankly, to this very day, they want to foreground a sexual element, which mainstream cinema usually avoids. Art house films can go much further than Hollywood, especially under the regulations of the production code at that time. So this idea that there's a sexual dimension which made the film more attractive is very much there. Even Mark van Doren, when he wrote about the film in his blurb, placed a strong emphasis on a highly sexualized scene in which an attractive female captive is menaced, groped, and eventually killed by a disturbed young soldier. And Mark van Doren says, "The incident of the girl bound to a tree will make movie history. It is at once beautiful, terrifying, and weird." And they quoted that in the advertising for the film. And the advertising to the film is extraordinary. First of all, Burstyn changes the title to Fear and Desire. And then together with Kubrick, they design a highly provocative marketing campaign. Kubrick, the young woman who plays the captive, the female captive who gets menaced, groped, and killed, is actually a model. And Kubrick takes very... very tasteful, erotic pictures of her. And he gets them published in leading magazines like People Today and Life magazine, and thus promotes, through Virginia Leith, the model, he promotes his star, his movie, and himself. And in the articles about that, there's again the strong implication that both for Virginia Leith and Stanley Kubrick, Fear and Desire is a step towards Hollywood, while at the same time, of course, there's a whole different discourse, which is not in Life magazine and in People Today, but is in the initial advertisements for the film, that it's a European art house film, which, because European art house films are so daring, has sexual elements, strong sexual elements, because that's what distinguishes partly European cinema. So the film is placed in this tension between the art house and the mainstream by Kubrick himself. After he fails to sell it to the majors, he has it bought by Burstyn. Now, Burstyn releases it in March 1953, initially in art houses in New York, then later in a few cities, in art houses in the city, in cities around the country. Now, he receives a lot of attention for this film again. Again, somehow he manages to get his film a lot of attention in the press. And the attention usually mentions, and the reviews of the film usually mention, that this is Kubrick's debut feature, that he's a very young person, that the film has a tiny budget compared to what Hollywood would do. The reviews usually judge the film not to be fully accomplished, but they tend to welcome the freshness and ambitiousness of the film and to register the promise of its maker. So the film is crap, really, but the maker of the film obviously is a young genius, and we can expect more of him in the near future. And sometimes this sense of Kubrick's promise has to do with the sense of renewal in post-war American cinema. It's quite interesting that the commentators seem to think that there's a lot of young blood waiting to rush into the American film industry, either into the Hollywood major productions or some more art house productions. The reviews seem to agree that the appeal of this film to audiences is limited. A Variety says, it's a natural for the art house circuit. New York Times says it's only for those who are interested in experiments. These severe limitations on the film's audience appeal seem to have translated into very limited ticket sales. I don't think that Burstyn made any money on it, and certainly Kubrick didn't make any money on it. And it's actually interesting that the money that the Rochmond, his friend and mentor, gave him, $500 out of $53,900, He was not able to pay back those $500 until much later in the decade. And there seemed to be constant letters from Kubrick to the Rushman saying, look, I still haven't made any money on this film. I can't pay you back $500. So we see that all of this is an absolutely financial fiasco of the greatest proportions for Kubrick. And in the light of that, he probably was quite happy that in 1953, the Seafarers International Union, a union of seafarers, of sailors basically, commissioned a film from him whereby he got a certain amount of money, a certain salary, to produce a 30-minute promotional film for the union. And again, we need to be reminded that Kubrick possibly had a future to become a documentary filmmaker working on commission or working on staff for production companies dealing with theatrical, televisual, or industrial promotional documentaries. But his at this point in the summer of 53, his chances ever to make it as a big independent feature film director were slim to non-existent because he already lost so much money. Once again, it's amazing that in this context, already in the summer of 53, he pipes up again. Because although the film, as I said, had not received very positive reviews, the filmmaker had been recognized as a major new talent. And somehow he translated that recognition as a major new talent into people giving him money to make his next movie. Interestingly, when asked in the summer of 53, because Virginia Lee, the erotic model, as I described her, she actually gets a studio contract, a 7-year studio contract. So they ask Kubrick whether he wants a 7-year studio contract. And he says, I wouldn't take a job with a big company. When you are independent, you can control all parts of a production and share in the profits. What profits? He keeps losing money, but there he is talking the talk. He is, however, not stupid. I mean, he says these things, but he's not stupid because he does admit in an interview, frankly, no one in Hollywood is asking him. So it's not like he has a choice to say, no, I'm going to stay independent, because no one is asking him. And he also admits that probably Fear and Desire was not the right film to make money from a theatrical release. He does actually admit that. And it seems to me it's quite important to think that when he approached the financiers, again, these are people that he knows from his neighborhood, probably friends of the family. When he approaches them for his second movie, he must have convinced them that his next film would be commercially viable, that it wouldn't be some artsy-fartsy existential nonsense or great art like Fear and Desire. I leave that up to you. It's actually a great movie. It's a great movie. But he said he would do a tragic contemporary love story set in New York. And eventually it was released as Killer's Kiss 2 years later. And he got... He stated in the summer of 53 that he already got $80,000 for this production. So as I say, he must have convinced his investors, these friends of the family, that he would make a commercially viable film. Look at the press clippings. They say I'm a great filmmaker. I just made the wrong choice of subject in the first film, but I'll do it better in the second one and I will sell it. So Now you could say, well, does that mean Kubrick is selling out at this moment? You know, did he want to be a really true artist with Fear and Desire? And when that fails, he caves in to the commercial demands of the industry. I don't think so, because I think he wanted to do that with Fear and Desire. He really thought, I think, that this was a viable theatrical release that he would make money on. It's just that he miscalculated. So him then being willing to design Killer's Kiss with a very, very clear sense of what kind of film it would be, how it would fit into the market, and who would buy it, I think it's not a sellout. It's just a better way of fulfilling his objective that I think he already pursued with Fear and Desire, which is to enter into the mainstream. There are actually quotes from summer 1953 where Kubrick doesn't say European art films are good, American experimental films are good, Hollywood is rubbish. All he says is, I can make films as good as Hollywood can, but with much less money. That's all he says. So he never says he wants to make different films. He just says, I can make the same films, but with much, much less money. And that's, in a sense, the foundation for his career at this stage. Now, how does he translate this? Let me just run you through what he does in the next few years. Oh boy. Between 53 and 64, he makes the series of 7 feature films. You already talked about Fear and Desire. The budgets escalate. Let me just give you the budgets. $80,000. These are projected budgets initially. $80,000 for Killer's Kiss. That's a pittance when compared to the average cost of a Hollywood movie at the time, $1 million to $1.5 million. So $80,000 doesn't sound much, but it's still 20 times the average annual salary in the mid-50s. Quickly closing in on and then exceeding the Hollywood average, the budgets of Kubrick's films escalate. Over $300,000 for The Killing, over $900,000 for Paths of Glory, an astonishing $12 million, the most expensive film ever produced in the United States. There were films which had been produced by Hollywood, but abroad. But the most expensive film ever produced in the United States, almost 99% of it were produced in the States. There were some shoots in Spain, but not much. $12 million for Spartacus, and around $2 million for Lolita, as well as Dr. Strangelove. Now, if Kubrick says, I can make films like Hollywood, but only cheaper, why do budgets escalate? And there's a big irony here. Because from a point of view of a filmmaker and the financier, sometimes the likelihood to make money is more with a bigger budget film than a smaller budget film. Especially if stars and pre-sold properties are involved. If you have little money, you can't afford stars, and you can't afford to buy attractive literary properties. A book that you want to adapt, for example. You can't do that. If you have more money, you're likely to get some kind of star and maybe a property that has already proven itself in the marketplace. So it's quite curious that it may be easier for someone to make money if you invest more initially than less. Secondly, Kubrick always talked about being forced to do all these different things on his films himself. And of course, he wanted to hire professionals. If you hire professionals, not amateurs like he worked with initially, although they all turned into professionals themselves later. If you want to hire professionals, they cost a lot of money. There's also the thing that after Killer's Kiss, he made what are called union films. He made films which where everyone working on it belonged to a union, and union regulations don't allow a director, for example, to do cinematography themselves. So for all these reasons, we can see how there's an inherent logic for a filmmaker like Kubrick to escalate budgets. Very, very quickly. And I want to talk a little bit about how that actually happens. But when we talk about escalating budgets, we are reminded even more how important it is to somehow deal with the major studios. Because the major studios, frankly, are the only ones who can give you a major budget. Or if you somehow raised the money for a film independently, the major studio is the only one who can actually buy your film from you and then release it into theaters. For a sufficient amount of money that you can get your expenses back. So throughout this whole period, Kubrick really is always thinking about the major studios. Now, I can say a little bit about how the major studios used to work with only with, like Look magazine, with people on staff. In the 40s, Hollywood switched from what is called the producer unit system, or the editor unit system as it was at Look magazine, to something called the package unit system, where Hollywood is quite happy to not have people on staff anymore, but to hire people for particular projects, or to finance a production company which hires people just for a particular project. It's in that context that Kubrick sets up, in 1953, his own production company called Minotaur Productions. Well, actually, I already made a mistake again. It's not his own production company. It's a production company that is owned half-half by him and the Bronx pharmacist called Maurice Bucell, who happened, I think, to be a friend of the family. And he actually was the main investor in the new film. Now, with the new film, Kubrick returns basically to Look magazine and to Day of the Fight. Because instead of making this arty film out in California about an abstract war and man's existential condition within it, he now has a script written once again by him and Sackler, although this time, because with the first script they co-wrote, Sackler got the sole credit. This time they wrote it together, but the deal was that Kubrick would get the sole credit. But it's actually co-written. It's a project about an unsuccessful boxer, again, helping and falling in love with a taxi dancer, a woman who dances for money with men. Not a hooker, taxi dancer, who is harassed by her criminal boss and his goons. Now, the film undergoes various title changes. Along Came the Spider, The Nymph and the Maniac, that's my favorite, Kiss Me, Kill Me. And later, of course, it was released as Killer's Kiss. It was produced during 1954 for a final budget of around $90,000. There's a couple of familiar names from Kubrick's films, Frank Silvera, who you will see as Mac in Fear and Desire, and Gerald Fried again doing the composition. But apart from that, Kubrick also still gets a credit for story, production, cinematography, direction, and editing. Because Killer's Kiss is the last film, non-union film he makes, so he can still do all these different things. But the crucial, so it looks like it's still a film in the mold of Fear and Desire. It's got a similar type budget, a similar kind of approach, but the most important difference is the commercial calculation is much more carefully worked out. What is this film for? We don't know what research Kubrick did, but we presume that we can be fairly certain that he read Variety, so he would know what the industry is talking to when it's talking to itself in the trade press, and he would have noted the proliferation of gritty, low-budget urban crime dramas, which today are known as noir, but weren't known as noir then. And he would have been aware that the special status that United Artists had. Because United Artists was a studio that released all kinds of films, but the strategy of United Artists was to give the filmmakers they dealt with the greatest degree of independence, more than any other studio. So Kubrick, wanting to be someone who is in control of his films, while at the same time trying to make a film that anyone would buy for more than the budget that it cost him to make the film, seems to have targeted United Artists with a low-budget urban crime drama. An example is that United Artists, for example, the largest supplier of United Artists was a guy called Edward Small, who sold films to them in the $100,000 to $300,000 range, and they were mostly westerns and crime films. So he had that model in mind. We can't know this. There isn't a letter where he says, I'm going to do an Edward Small. But we can deduce, I think, from the evidence that he probably had that in mind. And he succeeded. He did actually sell his little movie to United Artists for a flat fee of $100,000, which means for the first time he makes a profit. Yeah, $10,000, that's twice, well, three times perhaps, twice to three times the annual average salary. So he's doing okay. Obviously, United Artists didn't make any money on this film because during the original release, it was only Variety described it as having a familiar plot. It blames the film's deficiencies on the fact that Kubrick did too much by himself. Variety said, well, that's no way to make a movie. You know, you can't do this. You're not good at all these things. Get some professionals in. A Variety said it may eke out some bookings as filler on the lower half of double bills. And you can't make much money on the lower half of a double bill. So United Artists actually made a loss, which is good for Kubrick because it wasn't his loss. United Artists, when making the deal for Killer's Kiss, did agree that they would invest $100,000 in Kubrick's next film. So the question is, how can he come up with a project that United Artists might approve? The most important thing that happens at this moment, oh God, is that I'm running out of time. But apart from that, the most important thing that happens at this moment, that between the completion, the sale of Killer's Kiss, and really thinking seriously about what his next project would be, he teams up with a partner, James B. Harris. You've seen him in the documentary this morning. Who's yet another friend of Alexander Singer's. These are all friends, these are all mates, but they happen to be either very talented or, in Harris's case, talented and rich, which is even more important. This is a guy who comes from a wealthy background. He worked in film and television distribution. Now he wants to make movies, you know, and he's got the money to do it. Yeah, who's going to stop him? So in a later interview, Harris explained the rationale for his partnership with Kubrick. He said, I told him he needed someone to raise financing. Find a good story. Professional actors and writers deal with practical problems, everything from financing to distribution, so that Kubrick could be left in peace to create. And that was the absolutely foundational moment in Kubrick's career, that he finds someone who knows the industry, especially the distribution side, who will take care of all these practical issues and will totally professionalize what Kubrick does, and has money. Has money. Yeah, no more uncles. The Harris Kubik Pictures Corporation is formed in probably at the beginning of 55, and they immediately start all kinds of things. It's quite amazing to look at Kubik's biography. At this moment, it totally explodes. His career, not the biography in personal terms, but in career terms, it totally explodes. The initial project is an adaptation of a recently published crime novel called Clean Break from 1955, which was a promising candidate because, in a sense, they sold Killer's Kiss. And United Artists says, we're going to give you $100,000 for your next film. But of course, the assumption is the next film should be pretty much like Killer's Kiss. It has to be another urban crime drama. And so Clean Break, which is about a heist at a racetrack, seems to be a very promising candidate. Now, there is some toing and froing about the rights of the film, and Harris in the end buys it for $10,000. Now you say, $10,000, what's $10,000? $10,000 is two or three times the annual salary of the average person. It's more than Kubrick's first two or three short films cost together. Yeah, this is a huge amount of money. But he now works with a wealthy guy. What's $10,000 between friends? Nothing. But not only that, what happens is that with this money that they have, they now start taking risks. And I will tell you, initially, that all terribly backfires. But we come to that in a moment. The other thing that happens when you have a partner is that you can actually launch different projects at the same time. Because in the film industry, the likelihood that any project ever gets picked up by anyone is very, very, very small. So unless you have several projects on the boil at any given point in time, you have no chance, really. With working with Harris, you know, reads books, he brings him books, he says, why not this, why not that, let's try this, let's try that, let's get someone here to write a little treatment of this plot, and so on. And Jeffrey Cox, actually, in this book, The Wolf at the Door, he actually has listed, going through various sources, a whole range of these projects in the 50s. And it's interesting, if you look at them, what they have in common. Most of them are adaptations of recent novels, very recent novels, the rights of which they can only buy because they now have Harris, and Harris can spend money. And these novels always deal either with crime, war, and or transgressive sexual relations. Yeah? War, crime, sex. I think, yeah, you know, this is the post-war period. You know, in retrospect, we know it's the noir period. War, crime, sex, I guess that's it. I mean, if you can't make money with that, you're hopeless. Especially in the low-budget sector. Especially in the low-budget sector, because Kubrick is still operating in the low-budget sector. Kubrick, the other thing that the collaboration with Harris allows Kubrick to do is to actually spend more time on the scripts, because the criticism of both Fear and Desire and Killer's Kiss was that the scripts were weak, that the whole films, in a sense, didn't hang together enough, they weren't thought through well enough, they weren't told in an engagingly enough fashion, they didn't tell stories which were engaging enough in the first place, so there was more time to work on scripts. And this is the period when Kubrick begins to obsessively work on scripts for years and years and years. Interestingly, Kubrick preferred to work with, and that's a curious thing about Kubrick, with inexperienced people. He didn't work with professional scriptwriters. He tended to work with novelists who either had written maybe one script before or no script ever. So he works with novelists. And the other thing interesting is he tends to work with these novelists for several years at a time. So Jim Thompson, for example, now a legendary a crime writer, then just another hack writer, he was asked by Kubrick to join him on the adaptation of Clean Break in the spring of 55. And he basically worked for Harris Kubrick Pictures for the next few years on a steady basis. He wrote, for example, the first draft of Paths of Glory. So he brings Jim Thompson on board to write the script, an inexperienced scriptwriter, but one of the legends of American crime fiction. Financial papers in the Stanley Kubrick archive indicate that the adaptation of Clean Break, which was shot in Los Angeles late in 55, and after several changes, title changes, was eventually released as The Killing by United Artists in May 56, had a final budget of just over $320,000. Now, but where is this money coming from? United Artists was willing to double the original budget, because they said we're going to contribute $100,000. Do $200,000, but they draw the line at $200,000 because the only star in inverted commas that Kubrick could get interested in this script was Sterling Hayden, who was a very minor figure. So United Artists said, we're not going to go any further than that. So that but their calculation said they needed 300, maybe more. So what happened? Harris's father gives $50,000. It's a rich family. And Harris himself has $70,000, which he just gives to Kubrick. Now, you can see how this is a totally different ballgame. $70,000 is virtually what all of his films before, I mean, at most, cost. This is $70,000 that Harris just gives like that out of his own personal savings. And then $50,000 of his even richer father that goes into it. So it's a totally different ballgame here, but these are enormous risks now. These are real sums of money that they can lose. These are 20 annual salaries that they're now playing with of their own money, or rather Kubrick is playing with Harris's money. The Killing is the first proper production. That's why they needed so much money. They had to work with real professionals. Of course, that immediately raises a problem. If you have this young filmmaker, by industry standards, completely unexperienced, unproven, a complete hack, why does Lucien Ballard, the cinematographer, why should he listen to anything that Kubrick tells him? And there are some interesting stories about how Kubrick had to fight to assert any kind of control over the production, because he was now working with experienced industry people who just wouldn't listen to him necessarily. So there's a win and a lose situation here when you finally go fully union, fully professional, fully Hollywood, even if you finance it partly yourself. So the problem with the financing of The Killing, as I said, was that they didn't have a star, a big enough star. This problem becomes even bigger when they try to develop their next project. The Killing, let me just say, well, basically, The Killing didn't really make any money, and I don't know where the figures are. I haven't seen them here on it. But basically, the Killing was too expensive to make any money back, and that put Harris Kubrick in a position which was very uncomfortable, because there was $50,000 of Harris's father on the line, $70,000 of Harris's own money on the line. So this idea that, look, this is not the way forward, this is a half measure, you know, we make this movie, we want it to find an audience, we want it to find a seller. Frankly, we want someone to finance the whole thing to begin with, but we know there's a problem. The problem is that we need a big enough star for an investor, a studio, or someone else to actually give us enough money to make the film. And this is a really crucial issue now. In 1956, after the release of The Killing, what they're trying to do basically is, after the losses of The Killing, they try to set up the next project. And what they have decided to do is to adapt a novel by someone called Humphrey Cobb called Paths of Glory, about a shocking miscarriage of justice in the French army during World War I. And they try to sell that to United Artists. And United Artists basically write back to them in October 1956 and say, they don't like the script, and they think that the project, which is basically very bleak, it's a very depressive project, needs a major, major star. And then actually the phrase is, a really top, top star is obtained. That's the requirement before United Artists can even think about backing this project. So now you have to imagine that Harris is basically has lost a lot of money already. Paths of Glory, the next project, the most likely financier of the film, United Artists, has rejected it for a weak script and absence of a star. They're really in deep shit, to be honest. What is even worse is they had actually had a contract with MGM during 56 to develop a project called Burning Secret, a Stefan Zweig novella that there was about, basically, it's sort of an extramarital affair seen from the point of view of an anxious young boy, a 12-year-old boy. This production actually never came off. They were hired by MGM to develop it, but MGM didn't like what they were doing. The management of MGM changed, they lost that as well. Plus, MGM had hated the idea that Paths of Glory could have been an alternative to Burning Secret. So they had rejection, they had failure, they had huge losses, they were in deep trouble. Which helps to explain what they did next, because they needed to attract a big star. not only to make the next movie, but to make up for the losses that had already occurred, for all the failures that they had already accumulated. Now, how do you get a big star? You have to do two things. You need an attractive script, and you need a certain standing within the film industry. And once again, Kubrick was excellent at publicizing himself. Already during the run-up of the release of The Killing in the spring of 56, the two partners, Harris and Kubrick, had taken out ads in the trade press to announce themselves as the new UA team, the new United Artists team. I mean, they're just selling their first movie, which their second movie, to United Artists. It will be a flop, but they're the new UA team. The film, as I said, lost money, but it received some very favorable notices in the press with a strong focus on the talent of its young director, who, according to Time, was a new boy wonder, comparable to Orson Welles in the early 40s. The New York Herald Tribune described The Killing as an excellent portrait of a crime, unusually taught, keenly directed and acted, and with a sharp, leanly written script. And in January 1957, the Saturday Review, which became the biggest supporter of Kubrick in the press, listed The Killing as one of the 10 best films of the previous year. There was even an Oscar campaign. Harris and Kubrick even launched a campaign to try to get an Oscar of any kind for The Killing, but they never even got a nomination. So through the publicity, not through the success of The Killing at the box office, but through the publicity surrounding it, they signal to the industry and to any possible stars in it, we're major new players, we're to be taken seriously. And then they rewrite the script. And the most important thing that they do with the script is they change it from an ensemble piece without anything resembling a hero into a star vehicle. They rewrite the central character so that he is in virtually every scene, that he really takes decisive action, and although he doesn't succeed, the central character, he does actually do the right thing, and he somehow comes away from it quite gloriously, so that in all this depressing mess that the film portrays, and I'm going to talk about this in one of my future lectures, this Colonel Dux, the main character, who is actually just one amongst many in the novel, becomes a role that a star might be interested in. And lo and behold, a star is interested in it, and that star is Kirk Douglas. At this point, and I have to speed up ever more, at this point they actually have to make a deal with the devil. You have to see where these guys are. Kubrick once made how much? $10,000 on Killer's Kiss. Everything else he did, unless it was a salary, all of it failed, lost money, disaster, fiasco. $120,000 of the Harris family, his partner's family, are both Harris himself and his father, are basically not recouped yet and are unlikely ever to be recouped through the release of The Killing. They're really in deep trouble. But they have this script which is attractive to a star. Now they are willing to make any deal with this star. Whatever this star asks, they're going to sign it. Harris describes the contractual deal because Kirk Douglas, who was the star, he had an independent production company and he released films mainly through United Artists, but not only. But he also fancied himself to be someone who supports young talent, and he said, "Well, I'm going to make this little movie with Kubrick because," and I quote a letter that Kirk Douglas wrote, "He's a very talented boy." This is what Kirk Douglas thought about Stanley Kubrick. And he thought that he could help this young man, you know, to become a proper filmmaker. But he wasn't just, selfless in all of this. Kirk Douglas actually signed these guys to a long-term contract so that all the films they would make in future, first they had to offer to him, to his production company. Because he thought, well, they have done nothing yet, which is of any commercial value. But you never know. And if they messed up making films which make money, I'd rather they make money for me than for them or for someone else. And that's the deal they entered. So think about independence here. Yes, Kirk Douglas' independence. But because they absolutely needed Kirk Douglas on this project, because no one else would produce their film, they had two rejections from United Artists and MGM already. No one would do it. They were willing to sign the contract. And Harris later said, "The killer was Harris Kubrick had to sign a deal with Briner, that's Douglas's production company, for 5 movies, 2 of which he would be in and 3 of which he did not have to be in. So we were going to work for Kirk Douglas at this point for our future." Yeah, they were selling their soul to Kirk Douglas, basically, which apparently is not a good thing to do, I hear, from what I hear about Kirk Douglas. But it got Paths of Glory off the ground. It was it had a final budget of almost $1 million. It was shot in Germany, and when it was released in December 1957, it didn't make any money. But that's the thing about United Artists. United Artists was willing to have contracts. It was willing to have a relationship with a star, an independent producer, and to balance two kinds of projects: prestige projects or vanity projects, and blockbusters. The hope was that if you finance one Paths of Glory that will never make any money for you, Kirk Douglas will give you The Vikings or some, you know, pirate blockbuster or something. And that was the deal. So no one was surprised when Paths of Glory didn't make any money, because it was a prestige project right from the start. But the important thing for Karras and Kubrick was that the film was, although never unqualified, the critical acclaim for the film was very high indeed. I'm just going to give you some examples. Time magazine went as far as including Paths of Glory among its list of the 12 best films of the year. The Saturday Review again declared it to be unquestionably the finest American film of the year. So basically, with this film, they established themselves as making now medium-budget films with major stars for a studio which is willing to support films of a prestige nature as long as it gets in return a blockbuster afterwards. Now, let me just think for a moment, because I have to stop now. You're getting restless, and rightly so. I would be restless if I wasn't up here. Okay, let me try to sum up what happens in the next 5 years in 1 minute. How do I get into these situations? What happens basically is that after Paths of Glory, Kubrick and Harris continue what they did before. They develop numerous projects at the same time. They enter into any deal that promises to make the money. Now, of course, they always have to negotiate with Kirk Douglas. But there's a lucky break, because Kirk Douglas's big film, which in the end he didn't release through United Artists but through Universal, but his big film, which compensated for all this prestige rubbish that he was producing, rubbish in industry terms. Of course, some of the greatest films ever made were produced that way, but in terms of the industry, this is all nonsense. But his big project was, of course, Spartacus. And a couple of weeks into the shooting of Spartacus, Kirk Douglas just hated what Anthony Mann, the director, was doing so much that he fired him, and he hired Kubrick instead. And that really changes the name of the game. At the moment, first of all, it changes the name of the game because for the first time, Kubrick is a player, a real player. Until then, yeah, the trade press paid attention to him, the critics and everything, and the industry was willing to give him some money, but basically only if it was backed up by a star. But now with Spartacus, although he's a hired hand, the man in charge is Douglas, who produces the film. Kubrick now is at the center of the most expensive film ever made, and he really has kudos in the film industry now. And it seems to be the case that it was more or less an understanding that in return for taking over a troubled production that Briner was working on, Douglas was basically willing to relieve Harris Kubrick of their five-picture deal. Because otherwise, Lolita, Dr. Strangelove, 2001, Clockwork Orange would all have made money for Kirk Douglas. But, you know, he later regretted that. Douglas says, oh, what did I do? You know, what an idiot I am. But basically, he had to do it because Spartacus was in so much trouble. And Spartacus, when released, was one of the top films of all time in terms of success. And at the same time, it was a huge, not an unqualified, but it was also a huge critical success. So although Kubrick, in a sense, was working for Douglas here, his association with Spartacus which sometimes was used, was actually commented on quite critically, where they said, you know, this young whippersnapper was put in charge of the production. They were lucky that he didn't mess it up. There was this implied sense that he wasn't ready for it yet. But the sheer fact that the film was finished, it was a big commercial and critical success, and Kubrick had been the director, got the credit for it, meant that from now on the industry perceived him as a blockbuster director. And he immediately translated this to develop one of his projects that he had been working on and had never been able to make a contract for, because this was the project that Kubrick wanted to have the kind of control over that he had given up when he made Paths of Glory with Douglas. He wanted to reestablish his control, but no one would give it to him. All the distributors would say, both United Artists and I think MGM said, we're going to make certain conditions for you to when we give you the money. But once Spartacus was made, they said, whatever, Stanley, just do it. Except it wasn't one of the major studios. That's an interesting side story. It was a Canadian company called Seven Arts, which was actually a television distributor, but they were moving heavily. It was actually a huge entertainment conglomerate. They were moving heavily into movies. And a few years later, they actually were big enough to take over Warner Brothers. So they became a major studio by taking over a major studio. But in the early 60s, they were actually what one would call an independent producer. And they were willing to give, apparently, I mean, we don't know the contracts, but they were willing to give Kubrick the control that he and Harris wanted over the project, and that project, of course, was Lolita. This film was very difficult to make because, of course, does anyone know the story of Lolita? Yeah, because it's, you know, older guy, sex with a 12-year-old. The production code had a few things to say about this. So again, the question of independence is very problematic here, because obviously you can't make this movie the way you want, because the production code and the Catholic Legion of Decency would have a thing or two to say about it, as you had to negotiate it. But nevertheless, he makes the film. It's a moderate, but quite significant, but a moderate, much more moderate than Spartacus, box office hit, and it achieves a lot of acclaim. And then afterwards, he gets Dr. Strangelove off the ground. Again, as far as we know, Columbia, at the point when they made... Seven Arts seems to have financed the Dr. Strangelove, and Columbia only bought the film later when it was completed. But again, Kubrick gets the money, he makes a film, and the film becomes not only as big a success commercially as Lolita, but it actually becomes an enormous critical hit. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in one of my later lectures. And I think it's that configuration of trying hard, self-publicizing, becoming known as one of the boy wonders of Hollywood, of the American film scene throughout all of the 50s. From 1950 to 1959, Kubrick was the boy wonder. You wonder sometimes how many years you can be a boy wonder. Don't you at some point get too old to be a boy wonder? But in any case, Kubrick was the boy wonder, but his films simply didn't make any money for him or anyone else until 1959. And it was just the kind of negotiations that I talked about, including the wealth of the people he knew who were able to give him the money to make the films he wanted to make. But it's the point when he makes Spartacus, which is not his project, and he actually disowned it later. He said, this is not my movie. But it's the success of Spartacus which allowed him to make Lolita and Dr. Strangelove on his terms. But his terms were to make films for mass audiences, which was exactly the aim of the major studios. And it's the success of those two productions which established him as basically one of the key figures in the American film industry. And it's that fact that explains why, in the summer of 1964, he could write in that memo that he wanted total annihilating artistic control. Thank you.